Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Looks like, again, we're at an OIG coffee table because Wade is, I mean, he's flat out, he's like a quitter. He's not, he's got to clone himself because when he has these conflicting meetings and doesn't make it, we pretend that we miss him. So it's all right. And by the way, I am obviously still here. I did not quit and go to the rodeo.
I pictured you as a rodeo clown, though, with the bandana sticking out of the back pocket.
Yeah,
running, clown. Popping out of a barrel, getting the
clown,
the bull's
not
attention.
Necessarily clown, not necessarily rodeo. So yeah, that was great. Went to my first rodeo. That was interesting. Not for me, but the rodeo was fun. I mean, you know, when I say not for me, I mean me being a rodeo cowboy or whatever you're supposed to be called, but. It was enjoyable. So, all right, whatever. We'll persevere without Wade. Wade, I'd like to say we missed you, but out of sight, out of mind. Some say absence makes the heart grow fonder, but you know, not really. So
Wade who?
Yeah, Wade, exactly. Wade who? So you know, so we want to talk today about. I really wanted to get back to talking about SIU operations and things of that sort, but then, you know. You get an article, a news press release, and it's got information on it that makes you say, I really am so disgusted, I want to talk about it. And so there was a press release out last week about a provider, a doc that owned a sleep center, probably pulmonologist by training, and he was providing CPAP machines to his patients that purportedly needed them. We don't know. I would guess there's probably some question about whether they were needed or not, but the CPAPs that he was providing to his patients and then billing insurance for, including Medicare, Medicaid, were CPAPs that had been the subject of a recall by the manufacturer through the FDA due to a number of issues involving foam that is injected into the CPAP mask. And that foam had some issues that caused it to break down. And so people had the potential of ingesting through inhalation of the foam. And the foam itself apparently may have had some carcinogens that were cancer causing. So unbelievable. So there was a recall. And what the provider was doing was he was getting recalled CPAP machines. They don't tell you how he was getting them. I am going to speculate that they were being purchased through third-party sellers, some of the sites, you know, the bidding sites like eBay and things of that sort, where you see a lot of that stuff go up on eBay. People have them. They don't need them anymore. And what this guy was doing was he was purchasing them. And then with his family at night, they were dismantling the CPAPs, removing the parts that were the subject of the recall, putting them back together, and then providing them to his patients and then billing insurance for them. So you've got a couple of issues there, right? You've got a product that's been the subject of a recall, which means it is no longer marketable for sale, is no longer allowed to be put out into the economy. And you've got, and they certainly aren't reimbursable at that point because it's no longer a product available to the market. So it is no longer equivalent to any other product on the market. It's been recalled. And so you've got the fraud piece of that. And then you have obviously the public harm issue, the patient harm issue that's out there. It's just amazing. And, you know, Matt, we were talking before I hit the record button on this. We were talking about the doctor, Farid Fada out of Detroit, the famous doctor who was doing chemotherapy treatments on patients that did not have cancer. And for those who have unfortunately been the benefactor of having chemo, you know, that's terrible. One of the side effects of chemotherapy could actually be cancer, other cancers. So obviously, when you've got a provider rendering services that are not medically necessary, when you've got people getting devices that are the subject of a recall, the patient harm factor is there. And while the Farid Fatata case is not the same as this, there's a patient harm issue that's out there. And so, you know, the thing, Matt, that when you read these press releases, the very first thing, you know, from the SIU perspective is we want to get in there and try to find the ways to protect the members of the plans that we are doing the SIU work for, because it's the SIU work isn't always about fraud, waste, abuse. It's also about patient patient harm and patient protection. But this is a unique one because unless you have certain authorities, for example, you know, I worked on some cases involving what they call carouseling of diabetic testing supplies, where people get the supplies. The supplies are proprietary to the blood testing devices, the glucose testing machines. And then what winds up happening is someone gets a new machine and the strips are no longer usable. They may have boxes and boxes of them. And then they go and they sell them on eBay. People probably have seen the lawn signs, you know, I buy diabetic strips, right? Similar. And the problem is that it's very hard to track those into, you know, when they get into the economy. And, you know, so that case that I worked, we had, obviously I was still DOIG, we had subpoena authority. We were able to track down to the people who sold the product to my bad guys through the eBay stuff. But this, from the SIU perspective, it's a challenge because billing data, right, doesn't reflect manufacturer, serial number, make and model. You could obviously, through the investigative process with the provider, you can get that information, right? So those that do DME investigations, you know that one of the standard things that you get in a DME investigation is you get copies of the bill of sale, right? Which shows you what that price was that they paid for, make sure the markups are within the statutory requirements. You also get serial numbers, make, model, all of that stuff. Here, from the SIU perspective, you know, unless you know that this guy is selling this product, you're going to have a, you know, a little bit of a time. But so data becomes a challenge here. And I know we always talk about data gives you a lot of information, but this is one of those where data doesn't help you. But let's talk a little about what are some things that investigators might be able to do.
Yeah, when I was with the UPIC, we actually set up bots on some of the local, you know, we had a set jurisdiction. We set it up on local periodicals and gray market websites and things like that that advertise these types of things for sale. And we would get hits and do like you did with the, you know, I sell, please sell me your diabetic test strips. We were finding similar types of things for other types of DME equipment, drugs, pharmaceuticals, and we were chasing those things. But it, you know, it took a long time and took a lot of effort to set up those bots and machine learning, we're, you know, adding to them, refining them. It took several months before we started getting some hits on that. And then we worked with the IG on how to resolve them, because at that point, you know, once they were in the marketplace, we really couldn't follow it because right. It wasn't going to a provider. It was going to like a wholesaler and things like that. We couldn't really track it. So, right. You know, we were able to dig up some leads, but really couldn't take it any further. And I just wanted to read something from this press release. To, you know, you talked about the things. This recall was classified as a Class 1 recall because there was, usually it says, you know, there's a higher risk of, this is reasonable probability that the use of or exposure to the devices would cause serious adverse health consequences or death.
Right.
This guy, it's amazing. And so, I mean, I'm sorry.
But here's the thing. The fact that, it's obvious from the press release, without knowing any facts outside of the press release, which we never really know, it is very obvious that this guy knew that these devices were a problem. And how do we know it? Because the press release talks about him and his wife and his kids using screwdrivers and hooks and other devices and tools to remove what they believe to be the offending parts, which is this foam insert that goes on the CPAP mask. So the fact that this guy wasn't just buying these products and reselling them because of shortages in the marketplace or whatever else that you would say would make him an altruistic human being, at the end of the day, that's your intent. He knew that these products were problematic and sought to do what he could to negate that problem, the problematic part of it, which is impossible to do, really. This is the whole point of the recall. And that is the thing that just kind of sets you off a little bit.
Yeah. You know, in terms of data, you know, this would have been very hard to find in the data. This guy is running a sleep center and the devices are CPAPs. They're going to get, you know, they're going to get ordered by someone like him. So it's not going to pop up in the data unless there's maybe a spike, a change in the charged amount, or because he's obviously paying less for them. Maybe, you know, he charged less or changed the charge amount, changed the volume of it. We don't know what the medical necessity was, but just on the surface, it would be very difficult for an SIU to catch this. They've got to have some other reason for looking into this type of behavior to catch what this person was doing.
Right. Well, and so one thing obviously is that once you know that this guy is a bad actor, you can run your data, find all of the patients that, you know, where the CPAP was paid for with him as the ordering physician. And that's going to give you some sense, because then at that point you have your universe of people. And then the question is, do you then look to do an investigation and go directly to him? Do you then start to reach out to your membership and ask them, hey, what CPAP do you have or whatever? The problem obviously is that now you're playing a catch-up game. It's after the fact. Is there any ability to get the money? He's been criminally prosecuted. And as a result of that criminal prosecution, he's going to be excluded from Medicare, Medicaid. Commercials will kick him out. So the question is, you know, what do you try to do? Do you then go after that money after the fact? The thing that I think kind of chapped me a little bit when I read this was he only got a year and a day, and his restitution is something like $400,000 or something like that. So, you know, the thing that oftentimes we people don't fully, I guess, appreciate is the year and the day is actually a bit of a gift, because under the Bureau of Prisons and the good conduct rules, you get 54 days of good conduct for every year that you spend in jail. So theoretically, and if you have, there's some other programs that the Bureau of Prisons has that allows you to get that sentence reduced even more. And so theoretically, if you are at a year and a day, you're really only doing about 10 months. Whereas if you had a 12-month sentence, you're doing every day of the 12 months. So under the federal sentencing guidelines, an inmate has to do a minimum of 85% of their sentence, because parole has been abolished. And so the 54 days of good conduct time would get you out in 10 months versus a year and a day. So when you see that someone gets a year and a day, that's a little bit of a gift. The other gift is the fact that this guy only got a year and a day when there was clearly a patient harm factor here. And that patient harm factor is an escalator or an aggravating factor under the sentencing guidelines. And so it leads me to believe that there's more to this story that we won't really know, because a year and a day, $400,000. Now, it was primarily Medicaid, I believe, so the dollar amounts are going to be lower. But even considering all of that, when you see that there's a case in which patient harm is implicated in the press release, a year and a day seems a little thin. Even though the guidelines are mostly driven by the dollar amount, it makes you wonder if there's something more to that that's just not our business to know. But a year and a day with a patient harm situation, particularly when you see that the FDA recall was a level one, means that's the highest level of a recall, because patient harm is likely.
Yeah. And it was, he bought over 500 of these devices, and they tracked 440 of them to false claims that he submitted to the Medicaid program. They don't mention who he bought them from, which I think is interesting. So that maybe he's cooperating with them.
So that's the thing that comes to that. That's the thing that comes to my mind is was there a level of cooperation? However, what you typically see in a press release is if there was cooperation, he would be the last defendant that would be sentenced, because he was cooperating. And then typically there would be information in the press release that indicated that he cooperated, because it's otherwise public knowledge. So I did think about that as well, Matt. It was just a little bit of a surprise to me to see that it was a year and a day for something where there was a patient harm related implication there. So, you know, kind of as we bring this to a close, because this one's a little unique in the sense that data isn't really going to help you on the front end, data is going to help you on the back end. This is one of those examples where it definitely behooves an investigator. Yet one more area to look at is, you know, getting alerts from the FDA on product recalls, device or otherwise, and then seeing if you can back end it and see, for example, okay, here's a device that was recalled. Do you then go and find out who are your top 10 dispensers or suppliers of this item or this product? And do you do some preemptive investigative work and reach out to your top 10? You know, a CPAP machine is going to be dispensed from a supplier through a sleep medicine. Do you look and see who are your top 10 suppliers of CPAPs within your area? And then of the top 10, do they have any commonalities in provider, or who are your top 10 referring providers for CPAP machines? I mean, there are a few things you can do from a data mining perspective to maybe see if there's some smoke where there's fire. The only way, I think, at the end of the day, correct me if you think I'm wrong, but the only way I think at the end of the day that you're going to be able to identify that Dr. Smith gave this product to this patient is going to be through an interview with a patient or a request for information from that provider on the manufacturer, because otherise you're not going to know.
The delivery slip or whatever is going to have.
Right. Because your billing data doesn't tell you. Your billing data doesn't tell you the manufacturer, the make, the model, the serial number. You only get that. And for those, again, those that do DME investigations know that you get that information from your supplier, bills of lading and all of that. But from the general SIU perspective, you're kind of trying to piece two things together. And that's where the challenge is. So it's one of those. It's nice to have the ability to do this if you have the time. It's definitely something where when you see that there is, at least from my perspective, if there's an instance where there's a patient harm issue, meaning if I saw this recall, my next question is going to be, how do I try to figure out what members from our plan have gotten this CPAP and how to fix that problem if they don't know it? I mean, if the patient is an elderly patient and they didn't, for example, register the product for the warranty, or the supplier didn't do it, or who knows, people slip through the cracks all the time. But, you know, part of it is how do you know that? It's a little bit like when we've talked about the diabetic testing supply cases, and the diabetic test strips are carouseled through, you know, the eBays of the world and stuff. At the end of the day, if there's a recall on those strips, and there have been numerous recalls on diabetic testing strips, if there has been a recall for the strips, how does the end user who's purchased them through a third or fourth party reseller know? It's a little bit like why in the drug world and in the diabetic testing world, they have pedigree, right? That you can only buy your drugs, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, you can only buy your medication from authorized wholesalers. This is part of that reason, is that from the supply chain perspective, you want to be able to know where that product ultimately is from that safety perspective. So this is the kind of case I think that presents a huge challenge for an investigator. And you may not get to a conclusion, but you can certainly identify within your plan who are your members that have a CPAP, and at least send out a blanket notification to say, if you weren't aware, this device was recalled. I think also collaterally, the question becomes, if you've identified who your patients are that have that device, and you know that you as the plan paid for it, what are the plan's recourses in getting reimbursed for that recall, right? Is it ultimately the supplier? Is it ultimately back to the manufacturer? I think that's a open question, but certainly something from a member perspective and from a overall payment integrity perspective, you'd want to have an answer to.
The other thing that they didn't mention in the press release was any type of referral to the licensing board. Why would this guy still be an MD with having conducted this? I'm hoping that they yank his license. And that's something the SIUs can do as well. If they get, not just with this, but with any type of allegation where there's patient harm, with the UPIC, we had 2 days to, if there was a patient harm allegation, to get it to the licensing board and get it to the IG. So
Right.
SAUs might want to follow that type of thing. If something like this comes to their attention, immediately get it to the proper authorities to handle that regulatory matter.
Right. And that's why having those relationships with your regulators has to exist. You know, your state regulators, your, you know, whomever it may be, that's, you know, your licensing board people. That's why that relationship has to exist. Because again, in the SAU space often becomes the place where it's not really, I won't call it a dumping ground, but oftentimes where you have a lot of collateral things to review that aren't directly SAU related, but still need to be addressed from a member perspective, at the minimum a vetting perspective, and, you know, ultimately move it to another department or to a regulatory organization. So, you know, this is a terrible case. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. It's a terrible case. The guy is only 50. The doc is 57 years old. He's going to do 10 months. Probably the dollar amount is much more than what it was, because that's always the case. The dollar amount is never penny for penny. And so, you know, does this guy come out, even though he doesn't have a license anymore? He's 57 years old. By the time he surrenders, by the time he gets out, he'll be a little over 58, close to retirement age. Did he do well enough in his practice? Does he sell his practice? Does he, you know, is he paying that $400,000 back and then selling his practice because he's in jail? And as a result of selling his practice in prison, rather, he comes out with millions of dollars. And, it's I had this discussion with someone the other day where they said, well, if I had millions and millions of dollars and I have to pay back 400,000, but I've got millions and I go to jail for 10 months, could I do it and just ride off into the sunset? So is the crime worth the time? In some cases, maybe, I don't know. I don't want to have a social discussion about it, but for this guy, $400,000 a year and a day, for a crime that appears to have, really strong patient harm implications, it just sort of is a head scratcher to me. Even if the dollar amount was low, one would think that his potential prison sentence would be more substantial. But, you know, who knows? We will never know the backstory. All right.
You have to hope for some patient civil suits against him as well.
Yeah, right. Something or payers outside of the Medicaid space that weren't implicated. And, you know, that's why now, you know, now you know the product. Now you know it's him. You got things to do, right? So homework for my SIU people out there. Go get them, I guess. I don't know. But certainly investigations can be spawned from a press release like this. It's after the fact. And the bigger question, again, as we said in the beginning, was it may not be a matter of if there's any money to be gotten. But certainly you want to at least be able to understand what the exposure is to the plan and treat it as potential offsets and things of that sort. So, you know, keep reading these press releases, because they do give you, if anything, for me, these press releases sometimes give me a fire to be a little bit angry about the way that things are. So, you know, we'll keep working on them. So, Wade, yeah, we missed you. Exactly. I don't know. As always, great seeing you, Matt. Great seeing everybody that comes on to the podcast, sees us, everybody who tunes into the LinkedIn Lives. We got a whole bunch of those coming up pretty soon. And again, YouTube and Spotify and the newsletter is how you'll get the podcast every week, as well as just clicking on the link on Fridays, like probably most of you did right off of LinkedIn. So until next time, we'll see you at the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you all.